Welcome to another episode of Surge's Faith, Work, and Rest podcast. My name is Jim Mullins. I'm one of the co-founders and hosts of the Faith, Work, and Rest initiative, and we exist to help people discern their callings, to reimagine their work in light of the biblical story, and to help people cultivate healthy rhythms of rest. If you are someone who is hungering or desiring any of those sorts of things, we would love to help you go deeper. We would love to walk with you, and that's what this podcast is about. The classes we teach, the resources we create, the coaching that we do, it's all for those things. And with that said, we have a resource, something we would like to get in your hands that we believe can be very helpful for you. We call it the Vocational Planning Canvas. It's a tool to help people work through questions of calling, to reimagine the hardest, most complex aspects of work, and to cultivate rhythms of rest, to set goals. It's not going to answer all those questions for you, but it is a tool that will help you have a degree of intentionality. So you can download it for free at faithworkrest.com. And if there are other ways that we can walk with you on your vocational journey, don't hesitate to reach out to us at faithworkrest.com. With that said, let's go ahead and launch into the podcast.
Hey there, this is Lauren Kutzko. I'm here with Jim Mullins. We've got another episode of the Faith, Work, and Rest podcast. And today we've got an interview with Brittany McFadden and Jim Mullins. And Jim, tell us a little bit about Brittany.
Yeah, so Brittany is, among many other things, she's a pediatric occupational therapist. So the big picture, and she will get into this, is she's helping children, oftentimes with various types of disabilities or different kinds of abilities, to learn how to do the basic things that they need to do to thrive in life. You know, things like holding a pencil or getting the food that they need when they need it. And it's really fascinating. I kind of got enamored with asking her questions to kind of get in the weeds of the work that she does, because I almost feel like everybody could use an occupational therapist. And here's what I mean. There are these small things, like seemingly small, but they're huge, like holding a pencil or being able to use a phone or, you know, certain communication things, that once you learn that one elemental thing, it opens up the ability to do a ton of other things.
Yeah. No, it makes me think of, I think I was probably early teens, maybe, when I remember computers started showing up, you know, in the library, or maybe my dad brought one home for the house eventually, or, you know, there'd be some at school. And I remember being taught to move a mouse and to double click. And, you know, I mean, it's funny even to think about that now, because so many screens are touch screens, and so many times you're not really double clicking on things anymore. But I just remember, like, at the time, like, if you can do that, then that unlocks all sorts of things that you can do on a computer. But if you don't know how to do that, I mean, it was an important enough skill that they would teach it.
Yeah.
In a computer class.
Yeah.
Like, here's how to double click.
Right. Right. And how many important things have you double clicked on throughout the,
Yeah.
And you know, it's interesting. I remember when I was a kid and I struggled to read. I've got dyslexia and big time ADD. And it got pretty late into my life, you know, junior high, and I could like barely read, but also didn't let people know that. And, you know, would get kind of fired up when someone tried to ask me to read, or if the teacher asked me to read, I would just like throw a book at a kid so I can get kicked out of class, that sort of thing.
Wow.
And when a teacher saw that and like really kind of helped me with some resources to kind of cope with some of my learning disabilities and things like that, that person coming alongside me really unraveled and opened up so many possibilities. And now I'm sitting here, I've got a book that just came out, and I could just barely read when I was in junior high. And I think that there is something really important about people like Brittany, who come alongside people and can walk with them in these important skills and gifts that is literally going to stick with them for the rest of their life. And so I have a ton of respect for Brittany, not just because of that work, but because of who she is and her role in our city, the way she can speak with waxing eloquence about like the theology of ballet. So a ton of respect for Brittany, and we hope you enjoy this podcast where we talk about occupational therapy and maybe propose the idea that everyone could use a little bit of occupational therapy in their life. Thank you for being on the podcast, Brittany.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm glad we get to finally do this.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us the brief bio of Brittany McFadden.
Yeah. I was born and raised here in Phoenix, and I get to now worship in a community that's like a mile and a half from the hospital where I was born. So it's kind of fun to have gone a lot of different places and now be kind of rooted here again. I went to college at ASU for undergrad and then started doing some international work. Ended up in Tacoma, Washington for graduate school where I got my degree.
That's not international.
It's not.
Yeah.
Came back.
Okay, got it.
Yes. Sorry.
Yeah.
Ended up in Tacoma, Washington for grad school and then started kind of re-following that path into international work. God brought me back to Phoenix. Again, kind of this in and out, and I landed in pediatric occupational therapy here following my master's degree. Worked in early intervention, 0 to 3 year olds in people's homes for a few years. Felt called again out of the country, did some work in Honduras for a number of years. And then for the last 3 years, I've been back in Phoenix working in a pediatric clinic as a therapist. Among other things.
So real quick, can you tell us what an occupational therapist is and what it does?
Yeah, that is a really hard thing to pin down sometimes.
But right.
Basically, we're looking at the things that people do that bring meaning to their life. So the philosophy of the therapy is built around that people need to be engaged in meaningful occupations to have a quality of life, to feel that they're contributing to the world around them, to have a good sense of themselves. And there are things that happen that keep people from doing the things that bring meaning to their life, whether that's a physical impairment or they go through something that they lose an ability that they once had. It could be things that are more cognitive skills. They can have a hard time remembering things or planning things. But whatever it is in their environment, in their person, in their social context that's limiting their ability to participate in the things that they would find meaningful, we come in and we help and analyze the activity, the environment, and the person and figure out where the breakdown is and then start to bring in suggestions and strategies. And there's a whole science behind the different things that we do, but we're looking to help people engage in the things that bring meaning to their life.
Yeah. So give us some examples of what type of activities would fall into that category.
Yeah. So I've specifically, like from experiences I've had, had a gentleman who had kind of in mid to later part of life gone, had a stroke. And one of the things that he just loved to do was rebuild old cars. And because of the stroke, he'd had some paralysis in his hands. His fingers didn't work the right way. Now, that also impacts how he, you know, handles buttons on pants and shirts and, you know, putting toothpaste on his toothbrush and all these other life skills that are going to have, you know, problems. But the things that were really meaningful to him were his ability to engage in this hobby of rebuilding cars. And so we even use activities that are related to the things that he loves to help work on all of those like fine motor hand skills and getting stronger and things like that. There's a lot of connections between doing meaningful work that your brain will heal and remember better than simply like squeezing something to make your hand stronger. But if you're squeezing something and twisting it to, you know, screw in something in your car because that matters to you, that the brain's going to make those connections and heal more quickly.
Yeah.
And so so that would be one. For children who I work with now primarily, play is, you know, one of their main occupations. It's how they're learning and engaging the world. So we're using mediums of different types of play to help them gain these skills that will carry over into other things, but we're using these meaningful occupations to work on specific deficits or skills that they've lost or never had to help them develop.
Yeah, yeah. So if I have this correct, someone will often have some sort of injury or something will happen, or they'll be born without the ability to do certain things, and you come alongside them and help them be able to do those things and to cultivate those skills again so that they can engage in the stuff that they really care about in life.
Exactly. Yeah, we're kind of looking like, where's the gap between where they're at and what they want to do, or sometimes it's a more of a need to do. Sometimes you have to convince kids that washing their hands and tying their shoes are, you know, what they really want to do.
And then what does rest look like for you? We're going to talk a lot about work, but how about rest?
Yeah, I think I'm always learning more of my need for rest and what that looks like. And at different seasons and places, that rest can be, it can be really hard to like kind of find, or it can look different than maybe I thought it looked like. Right now, the pursuit of space in which to rest and just to be still before the Lord, or to have time to process the things in my life, or have space and capacity to be in relationship with people, has meant limiting some of the, even as we're talking about work, some of like the vocational pursuits that I've maybe otherwise wanted to do, or limiting the number of hours that I could otherwise work, or benefits I may otherwise receive, or promotions, in order to honor kind of that need for rest. Then there's also, I have a weekly rhythm of just taking time for specific like prayer and just being quiet with the Lord, and then kind of have built in like a yearly retreat into that as well, just to be still and quiet. And then rest of finding space and people where I feel like there's a serving and a restfulness and a relationship that all kind of overlaps. Sometimes I'm particularly living in ministry contexts, not your conventional like 8 to 5 job or 9 to 5 or whatever your work schedule looks like, that you can't just carve out a day and say, this is my day of rest, or no one's going to interrupt me, no one's going to have a need. But being able to find rhythms of rest inside of that, and time to refresh and remember and be centered in Jesus for the work that he's bringing. And
Yeah. So you said sometimes that means giving up benefits or promotions in order to have that space. That sounds like blasphemy in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. What does that look like?
So specifically right now, I feel like there's a couple things that God has like called me to, and like everybody, I only have 7 days in a week, and they're only 24 hours long. And so to do that well and still have space to rest and do those things, I have repeatedly had to face the decision of, and for me, it's been one to not take a position that had some of the paid benefits, security,
You
know, and have turned down, you know, other opportunities in that realm. Just because right now I feel like that is the way that I'm to be faithful with the things I've been given to do and to do them well.
Mm-hmm.
But that has not always been like, that's not like a easy choice sometimes. But it definitely has like confronted my own like sense of like, I have to figure out a way to be secure or financially stable, or but the Lord has like continued to like meet me in those decisions and things that have been, I think, in obedience to where he's just put me right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's been kind of a different journey of questioning who sets the standards of productivity in our culture, and who decided that, you know, working this much till you're ragged and worn is necessarily good for the human involved, mm-hmm. or the humans I'm serving.
Yeah.
If I'm drained and my job starts to become, you know, a burden, it's reflected in how I treat my kids. It's very hard to muster up.
Yeah.
You know, and it's demanding to have focused attention on one child's unique needs for a complete hour, both physically and mentally and different things, and do that repeatedly. And for me, just learning to honor the way that I'm wired and made and what I can handle may not be what others do. You know, sometimes you'll have someone, well, I could do this and I did that and I was doing this when I was you, and you know, and just honoring like them and what they can handle, and being okay to say, that's great. I know that that's not the way that I'm wired, and I have to respect kind of my weaknesses and my limits, and then, you know, live into that.
Yeah.
And accept kind of that humble place of saying, this is all I can do right now.
So let me go back to that. I really think that that perspective on rest is really important, that oftentimes when people think about rest, we think about it as me time, but really you're saying you need to rest well in order to serve well, that that's not just about you. It's about the people that you're serving.
Absolutely. And some of that comes into like self-care time, like, so physically, my job, if I don't take time to take care of like my own physical body, I start getting hurt at work and it influences. So just physically, if I'm not well rested and I haven't taken time to kind of, you know, not sit hunched over at my computer for a few hours doing paperwork, but I took a walk and I remembered to breathe deeply and I remembered to, you know, just not let the busyness and the demands of my work kind of drive my schedule, that impacts so much how I approach a session. I start to then lose kind of like creativity. So much of my work is responding to individuals and needing this like breath of inspiration for ideas that will connect with them. And if I'm just super overloaded and I haven't made space and I slip into not using work in a stewarded kind of way, I'm now using it and I'm just busy. It totally impacts my ability to serve well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, give us a snapshot of your work. And so I want to do this in a couple different ways. Mm-hmm. First of all, would you give us a snapshot of the worst day possible? Like if everything goes wrong in your work, what does that day look like?
There's a lot of possibilities of what that could look like.
Yeah, give us the most specific, like maybe even remember some things.
So it would be if all of these kids showed up on the same day.
Uh-huh.
So, getting called the worst names in the book because someone's brain isn't filtering and they don't realize that they're telling you these things. And they just snap into just a whole string of explicatives in your face and you're the worst person in the world. I've been hit and bit and kicked, and, it's really hard to just like respond graciously and not like go into like, I have a hard time without like that self-protective reflex. So if all of those kids showed up back to back, my kids that are just, you give them directions and you have such a plan for them that day, and they just lay down on the floor and, you know, every time you come close they try to kick you, I'm tired, I haven't rested well, I'm short on patience, and so like little things, I'm irritated. My kids and I aren't connecting. I'm not getting good like feedback from them. They're not making eye contact with me. We're not like finding a groove together. That would be a really, really rough day.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. Being kicked and called names. Yep. I could see it. Now tell us what a great day looks like.
Yeah. So every single kid is so unique. And so when I can just sense that we've connected, whether they are able to express with words what's going on in their world and what they're thinking or not, being able to share in kind of a back and forth communication with them, when moments they'll just burst into laughter or they start to giggle or express delight in their own way. So a day when there is just those great connections, there's laughter, they're excited to learn things, they're learning skills that maybe we've been working on for 6 or more months, you know, and we get to see it for the first time, and mom is sitting there, and mom's crying because all of a sudden there's something new, and this kiddo maybe is 8 or 9 years old, and they've just picked up a skill that, you know, we'd normally say, well, that's really simple. But for them, it's been huge and hard to do. That would be a really good day.
Yeah, yeah. But why would you say it's important for you to connect in order for a child to learn how to tie their shoes or to hold a pencil or something like that?
Yeah. So I work really from a philosophy that, like, I myself am part of the therapeutic process and how they're learning. And so the art of the self and, like, what you bring into the relationship is super important, especially with kids, that there's trust and love and they're feeling heard and responded to. Because I'm trying not just to have them tie their shoes, but I want them to have a sense of being able to cause something to happen in their world, that people are listening to them, that they have a yes and they have a no. And so trying to honor all of those things with my kids at all times. And then if the opportunity or the occupation is meaningful to them, I know that they are going to learn more. But if it's my job to figure out how to find and make something meaningful to them, because they might not know yet that that job is going to be really rewarding to them, or it's going to be really cool that they suddenly can control their body in a certain way that was so hard before. But if we don't have a good connection, they have no reason to trust me. They have no reason to do what I'm telling them to do. And I'm asking them to do things that are hard. If I just tell them to do things they can already do, we're not going to grow and learn anything. And so for them to follow and engage with me, we have to have a good connection, or they're not going to trust me when I ask them to do something hard. So sometimes if I'm pushing, I'll know that something was like too hard, whether they're aware of it or not. Maybe it was just challenging to their brain and it made their body feel funny or something, but the kid may suddenly start, you know, kind of acting in a way that's, you know, odd. They break connection. They're not looking at me. They're running around the room, or they crawl in a corner, or they might start seeming upset. I usually start with, oh, I gave them too much. I pushed too hard. And so I'll back up and pull them into something that I know they love, know that they're going to connect with. And I stay there until I see that we're back in connection. And then I start to kind of nudge them towards something more challenging again. Because if I push them too far, we'll break that connection and they're not going to want to try.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So it strikes me as you're talking about this, when you're talking about occupational therapy, it's really the work in its most basic form, with children, like the type of stuff that is often associated with play, and like the kind of the foundational skills and types of human work. And I wonder what advice you have for the people who are listening. Because one of the reasons why this podcast exists is so many people struggle to find meaning in their daily work, and you throughout the day are helping people find meaning in simple things like opening doors and, you know, a whole array of those sorts of things. What advice, or I guess the question is, what have you learned from helping these kids find meaning in those tasks that could be applied to everybody who's trying to make meaning out of their work?
Kids need, there's skills that we need to learn, you know, to be more functional and to be more independent. And so the task may not always be the thing that's really exciting and fun, but learning how to do that by just practicing that one thing can be just so boring and not motivating. So we're going to maybe disengage from the really boring task and learn kind of the pieces of the skill inside of something more fun. You know, if it's not fun to, you know, button this piece of clothing, but it is really fun to get into that bag because there's toys in that bag. I'll set it up so that now I've got to get through buttons to get there. So it's, you know, there's some modifying that happens sometimes, or there's some learning. And then now I'm confident I can do buttons and I come back. And so there's, when I say that, like, we're, you know, figuring out ways of making meaning, it's not necessarily like a false meaning, like something I have one kid who just hates tying his shoes.
Yeah.
And he just does. And yeah. Now he can do it. He just hates doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't, you know, it's not like all of a sudden that skill or that occupation or that task has suddenly become like the most amazing thing for him. He just still hates tying his shoes. So as far as looking at like how does our vocation and our work,
So let me engage with that a little
yeah.
bit. Yeah. So that child needs to tie his shoes, assuming it's a him, I think, yeah. Or, yeah, it's probably multiple kids. So tying his shoes, that has a lot of ramifications for the day.
Yeah.
What role, how do you help him see the benefits of life with tied shoes?
Yeah. Sometimes it's through a story. Sometimes, like, my kids that are a little bit older, we'll just talk about, like, going out with their friends or hanging out or things like that. Sometimes they don't have maybe a clear idea of where that skill is going to go. So building in just when we get to do this, we get to go to, you know, we're going to go play outside, because that's really important, like, especially in Phoenix in the summer. If you don't have your shoes on, you know, and sometimes I'll let them try it out. Like, what happens if you don't tie your shoes and you want to do the obstacle course that we built that you're so excited about? Mm-hmm. It's really tricky if your shoes aren't tied. Mm-hmm. Do you think it'd be a good idea if we tied your shoes? You know, let me help you. Let's try it. And, you know, we'll walk through it that way. So kind of building in some ways that this matters and this is important, but seeing it inside of a context of other things that they want to do. So
yeah.
Kind of going back to how do we then, you know, build in that meaning? I think you have to have an idea of the bigger part that what you're doing is playing, or the story that it's a part of, or the way that it's helping you grow or learn to connect it to something else.
Sure, sure. So let me give you a little scenario. Let's say someone is working as a real estate agent and they're struggling to go do the marketing that's needed to get their name out there, to be able to sell houses and those sorts of things. They just can't get the motivation to do it. How might you apply some of the stuff that you do to their situation to get them to do it and to do it well? And if nothing comes to mind, that's fine too.
I'm like, I don't know anything about marketing or real estate. So here we go. I think if it's just like completely not a motivating task, we just start at analyzing like the breakdown of what's needed. Sometimes I think motivation can simply be, it seems too big and I don't see the point. Mm-hmm. And like, how do I accomplish something that's like, there's 87 steps, but I'm kind of looking at them as like one lump. I just have to do this and it's so big. So with everything that I'm looking at with a child, so then I would look at, you know, this issue of marketing is how do I break this down into like, it's a lot of it's like goal setting and what's the next measurable or the next achievable step. And making that something, maybe you can find that piece is a little bit more motivating and something that you've maybe been working for. And I'm like motivated by like, oh, I got something done. Like, mm-hmm. I made some progress doing something that's like just too big from zero to the completed point is sometimes really daunting. And so a lot of what we are doing is just analyzing the task and figuring out for this person, how big can the steps be so that they're not shutting down motivationally.
Mm-hmm.
How little do we need to make them, but not too little that we're bored or it's just like, you know, this is so silly. Why are we doing this? So I don't know how that would necessarily extrapolate to marketing.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're doing something that, you know, that's, you feel like you're in this place or you work in this job in real estate, you need to do this step of marketing to be able to maintain your job. Not, you know, looking at, you know, maybe that needs to be your motivating piece. But if it's you're shutting down because it's too big, or you just, you know, what are the parts of marketing maybe that you can connect with that you do like and make those more prominent in the kind of the rewards of going forward?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's helpful. I think that's helpful. I think I see your facial expression. Like, why are you asking me these questions? But I think that there is really some wisdom there, because when it comes to setting goals and getting things done, people will know why they want to do their work oftentimes. But then there are these big pieces that are so daunting that I think that there is some wisdom to taking that approach and saying, instead of having this massive goal that's big, it's difficult, it's nebulous, of really reflecting on what are the pieces of that thing and working on the pieces in order to get at the whole, I think that there's some wisdom there for sure. And also, I think you were talking about with the kids, like in the shoe tying scenario, of helping to connect tying the shoes to what that means for the rest of life. And I think in our day, we have a very differentiated marketplace and differentiated work that's where people are doing small segments or a small piece of the puzzle. And part of what it means to have meaning is to see how tying your shoes connects to playing on the playground, and how working on that spreadsheet connects to the city getting water, mm-hmm. or people getting homes. So I think that there's some wisdom in that. Well, let me ask you this. What's something from your work that you've learned that if the whole world knew it, the world would be a better place?
Something I learn from the people that I work with over and over and over again is that each person is like growing and developing at a rate and in ways that I have no control over. And I think that kind of goes to some of that about connection, is I have to figure out where they're at and follow more where they're going than I'm necessarily always telling them what's next. The skills that emerge and what becomes motivating as kids grow older, or as, you know, as adults, as we go through different things, what's motivating to us, it changes. And so I have found that this has been something that I've like seen, not just as a therapist working with the people I serve, but with people that I'm walking alongside with discipleship, or just friends, or when you just feel like someone should be beyond something in their life or growing in a certain way, that I don't know the plans of what's the next growth point for them, but my job is to like get in step with where they're going, where the spirit's moving them, and help them along that trajectory. So I'll have kids that come up with like ideas and things because I'm watching them. And then I'm like, oh, I'm seeing that this connected. I never would have thought you'd be interested in that. My job now is to figure out creative ways to build on that particularly motivating activity or that passion or that desire, and find ways to support and build in skills. So I work from a space just as a therapist where I let the children lead a lot in kind of where things are going, because I can then layer in activities in our play that are working on specific things that we need to get done. But I think looking at how that's impacted the way that I see people, working alongside people, helping to see like that piece about smaller steps towards longer term goals, that sometimes the people I'm working with outside of therapy, but just in life or discipleship or in the community, that I may be asking something of them or expecting something of them that they don't have the capacity for. And I've seen this just ruin so many relationships, especially when you're trying to mentor or see someone grow in a skill set or in their relationship with the Lord, that we have an idea of where they should be right now, let alone where we think they should be going. And we're not really good at analyzing the task before them and setting steps for them that are helpful. So I've personally seen how this is like has been impactful in my relationships, not therapeutic relationships, but simply seeing, wow, they may not know how to get from this step to that step. I may need to insert 5, 6, 10, 20 steps between here and there. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't fault them for not being able to do that yet. And I can then help them see the next bit. And they may be able to take, you know, larger steps later. But right now, this is where they are. And so that one piece of my work has helped me see kind of discipleship and relationships and helping people grow in a different way.
Hmm. That's good. If someone came up to you and said, why does your work matter to God? Like, show me in the Bible, tell me what theologically, like, why does your work matter and you shouldn't just go do something more important, like be a missionary or a pastor or something?
So I feel like that I started learning more about like holistic personhood and what it looks like to participate in what God is doing in the world. Kind of was introduced to it almost more as a therapist first, and then started hearing theology that was more whole, like from beginning to end, the whole story, your work matters. So I didn't like grow up necessarily in that. Like really spiritual people were missionaries and pastors, and then like the rest of us were just like kind of second tier. And so later on, it was the theology started to be more robust and all of life and what it means to rest in the gospel and work and in rest and in, you know, different types of work. But I think I started being kind of brought into this way of seeing development in people first and then into this. So as far as my work and how it participates in what God is doing, there's, I think, a lot of layers. We are meant to cultivate and to grow. And so I'm entering with people and helping them to cultivate their gifts and talents and skills and abilities and their brain and their body and the way that they process information and helping them to do things that God has called them to do. I don't know what God's plans are for some of my, you know, for any of my kids, and specifically, you know, some of them, I don't know, you know, I have to grapple with a lot of really hard questions because some of my kiddos and their families, like, there's just unanswerable questions of why they're like this or this has occurred in their family. But learning...
What do you mean?
Children that have gone through really devastating, accidents, disabilities, things that have hit families, you know, by surprise. Their child's born with multiple issues. They are, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, and they can't sit up by themselves. They're on a feeding tube. They may never walk. They may never use their voice to communicate. How does that, you know, not just impact the future of that child, but the family? And what does the gospel say to that? How do I honor that this is a child made, you know, by our Father and with purpose and with plans? And what has God called them to do and participate in the world? And having that value and understanding of his love for them in the session with me, and as I think about ways to help them grow and develop, I'm stepping in to participate in what has God called them to and what does he want to cultivate in them. So stepping into the cultivating and the restoring aspects. Some of the kiddos that I have on my caseload right now had skills, and because of seizures or different disorders or different things, have lost skills. And so sometimes it's a family had a child that was doing really well and something happened and now they're not. And so now I'm participating kind of the restoring. They're young, and so there's skills that they've never learned, but there's also this aspect of their there's broken things that were there and we've watched them be broken. And now we get to participate in seeing them be healed and grow again. And I have a job that someday won't be there, which is, you know, someday, but the aspects of helping people.
What do you mean by that?
Well, that someday the world will be healed and whole. And so there's an aspect of what I do that won't be here, mm-hmm. but there's an aspect of it that will, because we'll always be learning. We'll always be growing. We'll always need people to break down the next step for us to keep growing, I think, you know,
I'm
assuming.
With you. Yeah.
But that we'll be constantly and forever growing and cultivating and learning how to do new things. But the side of it that engages with the hard questions of why did these genes and chromosomes and things form this way and not that way? Why did this, you know, tragedy happen, or why did this stop working? I think that the gospel tells us that those things will pass away and eventually won't be there. But in the meantime, getting to demonstrate just God's patient, redeeming work. And for a lot of my families, it's just you enter in with these kids and they have a really bad day and they come to therapy and they're just off, and parents sometimes are apologetic or they don't know what to do. And just to be able to say, you know, I love your kids. We're going to meet them where they are today, and we're going to do what we can today, because that's part of life and we have those days. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Yeah. So it's interesting that you said that you entered into this through a tacit knowledge that all of life matters. You kind of knew it, even though the theology wasn't there to match it. As you were doing the occupational therapy, you kind of knew that these things mattered. But if I understand correctly, that you had some theological perspectives that might have diminished the value of those things. Was there any sense of dissonance?
I think it was more like as some of the philosophy of the field, it was just like, well, yeah, like how could that not like resonate? And I think there's a lot, you know, in this field of research and study that aligns with things that we know to be true because of the way that God's ordered the world. And so to like see how those things, like, yeah, it matters that we're engaged in, you know, a sense of contributing meaningful work in the world, and what happens to people when they don't have that sense of meaningful connection and participation. And then later to see the kind of broader understanding and deeper like realities of the gospel, like, oh, that's true because of this is the way the world was ordered. This is the way God made things to be, and learning to see that. So I think it was like, I don't know, there was a dissonance of like, this is different than what I kind of thought before. Mm-hmm. But when I stepped into that, and then later the kind of the unpacking of the whole story of who God is, it was more of like, oh my goodness, I've been like, I kind of knew this was true and I just wanted it, and now you're telling me it's actually true.
Yeah.
So yeah, the way that those two have kind of played in my life, and not necessarily one before the other, but coming more from like the therapy, kind of opening that up, and then more of like the theology side.
Yeah, yeah. There really is. There's a philosopher that is quoted a lot by the professors that are both in our master's program, Polanyi, who talks about how that tacit knowledge, that knowledge that isn't necessarily locked into propositions and stuff that you can even necessarily articulate, but you know it, and you know it in your bones. You know it through engagement in the world, is just as much real knowledge as some of the more articulable, I don't know if that's a word. That's maybe that articulable word is not very articulable, but I don't know. It's going in the dictionary. I'm going to root for it. But those sorts of things, you can't articulate them, but that is a real knowledge. And it seems like your own physical engagement with this practice had a better theology than maybe your even stated theology at the time. What would you say?
Totally. Yeah, I grew up, whether this was explicitly taught or it was just the way I heard it, was that there were definitely like careers that were honoring to God and ones that were just like, meh, whatever. And so like early on in my life, I think a lot of my kind of what am I going to do with my life that you are supposed to figure out by the time you're 15 or whatever.
My 15.
I don't know. When they're asking you like, hey, you're going to be taking your, you know, your test to take the test to prep for the tests that are going to get you, you know, into the rest of your life, and you have to decide and you're not an adult yet and you have no idea. Those were definitely like, there were things I wanted to do with it at the time. I didn't see how that could be used by like Jesus in like a holy way, like which now I look back and I'm like, I could have done all these things I wanted to do and that would have been great and the Lord would have been honored and used, you know, those things to do things. But it's just part of the story of how I landed kind of where I am and the different things he's used. And I think also given some understanding of just how deeply important it is to have a theology that informs the way that you work and the way that the questions that we ask kids. And, you know, even the kids that I work with who you might look at and think, you know, you're not going to particularly like participate in serving the world outside of maybe your family someday. But I'll even ask, you know, ask them, how are you going to serve the world when you grow up? You know, what do you want to do to make, you know, the world better? You know, how do you like to love people? Or, you know, and trying to reframe the questions beyond like, what are you going to do, you know, when you grow up and things like that, even with the young people that I work with. But yeah, I did not have a robust theology of work and participating in all of life with the Lord growing up. And then when I went into kind of the process of and how I ended up in this field, but seeing that now, I'm just grateful to have, first of all, had the Lord just open my heart and my eyes. And, you know, the richness that comes from participating in, like, his story and that it's so big. And I don't think I could do this work in the same way without some of that now bolstering and giving shape and form to what was a philosophy of a practice but now is more of who I am.
Yeah, that's good. When God looks through your eyes and sees the stuff that you see in the course of your day, what do you think makes him smile and what do you think makes him weep?
So folks with different experiences of disability just face life in such a more complex way than I think we're aware of. I come against systems that are broken and, you know, perspectives on who should support and help pay, you know, who's going to help pay for this child. And it's not always just therapy. It's, you know, they're being denied, you know, things that could really help, whether it's equipment or a surgery or, you know, different things. And so just seeing like the brokenness in systems that are just not always the best, like insurances and, you know, medical models and different things for standardization, for billing purposes or whatever, aren't always what would actually best serve a family.
Yeah.
And we don't always get to practice what is actually the best thing for a family. That's irritating. And I think just so frustrating. You know, I don't get paid if I go do this, or if, you know, it's not that it's outside of my scope of practice. It's not that it's, you know, not something I'm allowed to do. There's just no way I can, you know, be paid for that. And sometimes there's those choices and I do those things because that's what's best for that. I would love to work in a world where you got to do what was best for your clients and you didn't have to like work inside of payment sources and, you know, all of those things. But that's, I think, one of the frustrating things. And so to see families denied services and care that would really help because of policies or legislation or, you know, just practices, unethical other clinics or services. I mean, there's things that go on in the business and in the kind of service area that, you know, are just wrong. People make choices that are self-serving and not, you know, good. And so I think those things are frustrating and I know that they are not what God would want. And, you know, if you say, you know, break his heart, think how families have experienced disability and prejudices and being left out, and having so many of these families have very little social support, have their kids have few friends. They, you know, I hear the stories from families when they get to hang out with a friend, mm-hmm. and like all of a sudden there's a friend in their life that is, you know, so massive. And so, you know, that's heartbreaking to know that a lot of my kids don't have people in their life outside of their immediate family who unconditionally love and support them and are going to be there for them.
Yeah.
You know,
terrifying.
I look at parents who are looking, you know, what does the future look like as they grow older, mm-hmm. as their child gets larger, as they're heavier, as they're, you know, facing different things, as certain kids, because of those same policies and practices, they may be aging out of services. They may not get to have things that would be helpful to them, and that's scary, and mm-hmm. parents don't know what they're going to do about that. And so I think those things would be some of those moments where it's hard. And then the things that like just the delight, just how much I learn from my kids, how much I am just amazed at the way that their parents love on them and in unique ways connect with them and appreciate them and what they bring to the world. Mm. And seeing the honor and the dignity, and not underestimating what they are capable of knowing and doing. And there's just like there's a couple kids that this week just got into fits of like uncontrollable laughter, you know? And so just those moments where there's just this deep delight and joy that is experienced and expressed. And some of these kiddos this week just have this incredible ability to just be social and engage with others. And that doesn't seem to hinder, like, there's this beautiful just acceptance of others, even though they may not be experiencing that they are not getting better.
And one of the things I've loved about the cross is I see that as Jesus's hands and feet are nailed to the cross, he is becoming the God who became disabled. Mm-hmm. And that's the God we worship. As people seek to follow that God into a world that looks away whenever they see brokenness, What would your advice be to them to take those little steps that you talked about, the little specific tangible steps to start walking in the path of the God who became disabled, rather than the worldview of modernity and the survival of the fittest? What does it look like to tangibly start living in the way of that Jesus rather than the Jesus we've remade in the image of Tom Brady or whoever?
I think some of it's just proximity. Hmm. So if you don't know anybody and you don't know their story and you don't have someone you can hang out with, then you may need to just simply start by, you know, finding ways to read and watch and listen to voices of people who, you know, experience physical or cognitive weaknesses that you think are just very different from your experience. But I kind of, you know, developed kind of a practice, I guess you'd call it, or just, you know, kind of occasionally, yearly, kind of like, who am I forgetting to like see?
What do you mean by a practice?
Just sitting down and thinking through like who I've forgotten to notice, who are people that I'm not seeing in my world, or, you know, just even turning the radio off when I'm driving, and who am I seeing in my neighborhood? Who am I seeing as I go to work? Letting the passages, like if you want to, you know, start at scripture, like go to the places where Jesus is with those on the margins or who he's healing, or, you know, who are experiencing brokenness. If there's tears, if there's weeping, you know, what's going on? Why is there tears? Why is there weeping? Why is Jesus weeping? What's going on? Am I seeing those people? Am I paying attention to those situations? We are just so allergic, I don't know, to suffering, to pain, finding ways to learn and listen, you know, just research, ask questions. You know, if you find yourself like shying away from someone at the grocery store because you're like the way they talk or the way that they're acting is, you know, you're uncomfortable. I don't know. Feeling that sense of uncomfortable is, I think, a really key thing to pay attention to and ask yourself why. Why was I uncomfortable there? How can I learn and grow and maybe read something or even simply say hello to that person that made me feel uncomfortable and get more close and yeah. Write down those like the distance and that bring in that proximity. I think you just to talk about it like theoretically or in like an abstract way isn't necessarily very helpful, but you need to know people, you know, and I can't say that like I had a whole lot to do with the people that I'm blessed to share life with who see the world and experience the world in different ways than I have. I count it an incredible privilege that they love me and accept me for all of my bumbling and ignorance. And when I miss a cue that would be really helpful if I didn't miss it, because now it's awkward and I have to like own that I missed like, you know, seeing something or doing something or overlook something. But paying attention and just seeing people.
Yeah.
So if you're not noticing people and you're like, oh, I, you know, this isn't something, if you're even hearing this and you're like, oh, I don't really think that's a thing that applies to me, I would highly encourage to sit down and reflect on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think the more you see, the more you experience those moments of, oh, this is kind of uncomfortable. And it sometimes, I think it switches to now not so much I'm uncomfortable with the situation and this person. I'm now starting to feel the pain of what they're maybe experiencing. And I'm starting to see how what's going on is, you know, it's an injustice against them or because of their, you know, situation or their disability or what they're experiencing, they're facing things that I wouldn't have to face. I wouldn't be going through that. And so it's not just that I start to see the individual. I start to then be able to empathize and feel and enter into the rest of their life and their story with them. So
yeah,
relationships and get to know people and start learning.
Well, yeah. And I think that practice that you have of asking that question, who am I not seeing, is so profound that I want to end on that. And as a matter of fact, if I remember, I'm going to try to tell AC to cut out the whole outro stuff where we talk about Patreon account and all that so that it's just awkward silence that someone hears in their car and that the last thing that they hear is the question, who am I not seeing?